Welcome to the show, all. I'm your host. Once again, we've revisited so many of the same movies and TV shows, so it's like we might as well talk about the frightening scenes, the gory scenes, the fight scenes, the other highlights, and then best moments. But when that's all said and done, one thing we'd love redoing is talking about the villains, because the villains is part of every story. And, you know, we've done it with plenty of other movies and shows. We did one with Lord of the Rings as the first part, and I just figured, hey, we invite Adam from the Virtual Seasons website, where people basically, it's more than fan fiction, basically people estimate what, you know, unfilmed material would have probably been the next season had the show continued on the airwaves. And Adam has contributed ones for what he thinks season 12 of X-Files would have looked like. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on. And yeah, that was sort of the idea behind the Virtual Season 12, was to do it in, like, you know, TV screenplay format, teleplay format, to, you know, something a little bit different than normal fan fiction, which is just like prose. And then to do, you know, what our best job of what we would think what, like, a season 12 would look like.
Yeah. Inevitably, it ends up becoming, hey, you know, if five different fans have talked about this, then it's just gotta happen, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it all just sort of came together so shortly after the last real season of the show. Just me and some other fans, we found each other, and we're still great friends now. So, like, friendships were forged from that experience as well. But we we all visited the X-Files Museum last year that opened up. I don't know if you've seen that. It's in Saratoga Springs, New York. And yeah, and they actually had there's a couple of fans that they've been collecting props and stuff from the show for a long time. And they opened up their own public museum. You can go like any day of the week. And they had Chris Carter came on the opening. And so we got to meet him and watch the pilot episode of the show together. I mean, it was definitely a fantastic experience. So they're having another fan event in the summer, I think June 7th to 8th, I want to say. I may have the dates wrong, but you can look it up. Yeah, they're going to have another fan event where they're going to have some, they're still announcing guests, but they're going to have some actors from the show. And then there's also a Minneapolis convention coming up later in the year, since it's the 30th anniversary in September. It's been 30 years since the show premiered. So, and I was there. I watched it with my mom when I was like 8 years old. So I've been a fan for almost 30 years now. So
I hear you.
This is I am game anytime to talk about the X-Files. So thanks again for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. We did one with the fan retrospect duo, where they talked about, you know, the best moments, and it was tough to pick a good moment.
You know, oh yeah, that team is great. They have a really great project that they've done.
They picked a lot of hysterical moments. I picked the submarine episode. It's a favorite. We had some other pals who just remembered just some other creepy moments featuring the great cigarette smoking man. And so it was just fun how, again, you know, if we're going to talk about a movie or show, instead of just, you know, not everyone can make every chat, so whatever way I can retcon the chat, and it's still kind of a fun highlight, and people are going to tune in because they're like, oh, see, you know, you're talking about just moments, but you're also detailing what kind of moments and everything. And this one is kind of one of those few shows that just about everybody has seen. Even people who weren't keen on it, you know, have seen it.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people will be like, oh yeah, that's the one with the mom under the bed. And, you know, like, you know, people who don't know anything else about the show, but they'll know like that episode, you know. I think that episode's like the most universally known among people who like don't otherwise know anything about the X-Files, but they know that, or maybe Tombs, you know, they know something about like the liver eating guy, you know, maybe Fluke Man. But I think those are the ones that, you know, seeped into, you know, very like casual viewership as well. So, I think villains is an interesting, cause you know, a lot of, podcast, you know, talk about top episodes or like, you know, what got you into the show, that sort of thing. And I think those it's a lesser explored topic. Yeah.
I know people who watch it only for the comedy, and others watch it for the monster of the week, and others watch it for the serialized episodes. The rest doesn't matter. And so, and there's others who like it all, but I, much like kind of every other like Dick Wolf or Steven Bochco production, it is hysterical seeing when Chris Carter, you know, develops Lone Gunman and sister show Millennium and seeing which actors he reuses.
I'm a Millennium fan as well, and I'm hoping one of these days we get a streaming or a Blu-ray release for that. It really deserves it.
I think it's possible, because on another note, for other Vancouver productions, we're finally, you know, I've been speaking to the Blood of Kings podcasters, and they're, which talks about everything Highlander, and they're supervising people at VEI who are finally getting that damn Blu-ray remaster to come out for the entire show uncut and everything. And I think it is very possible that Millennium may very well join that. That would
be amazing. Yeah.
I don't know what stopped people. I could have sworn maybe it was on one streaming site at one time or another, but all you can really find is just certain episodes on YouTube and everything. And I would like to think that, you know, Hulu being owned by Fox could definitely
have it on. It seems odd, because if you go back and look at the ratings, during the 90s, the ratings weren't that great. They were sort of mid-tier show. But if you look at that compared to like viewership of TV shows now, like the Millennium is watched by way more people than shows that are considered very popular now. Mm-hmm. So and then plus you've had that show was so ahead of its time, because you have shows that came out after like Mindhunter and Hannibal and Criminal Minds and all these things. And so they owe a lot to sometimes admittedly they owe a lot to that. So it does seem like, and I know Chris Carter is talking about, trying to reboot that as well too. So we'll see, you know, maybe something will happen with Millennium too.
Totally. I was speaking with some of the other guys when we did the ginormous chat, and it was so hysterical.
Yeah. I listened to that one. That was a good discussion of all the shows. Yeah.
Hopefully we give it its worth, but it was funny how, yeah, just the writers have various viewpoints, and it's like they're just so close. It's just sometimes.
Well, I think that the X-Files was one of the first shows that I think people took notice of who the writers were, and a lot of big writers came from, obviously Chris Carter, the creator, but obviously Vince Gilligan, who went on to do Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, which are amazing, and Howard Gordon. Did 24 and Homeland. He has a new show.
Chip Johansson.
Bill Morgan and James Wong. All these people that came from, and like people would notice and have like their own personal favorites, or like, I like the Darren Morgan episodes the best, or I like Vince Gilligan's episodes the best, you know. So I think way more than other TV shows, people noticed who, you know, maybe some people did with Star Trek a bit. Like, I think Star Trek was a little like, oh, this episode's going to suck because whoever wrote it. But but I think with the X-Files, all those main writers went on to do.
They were pretty much all part of that same family. Yeah. If they weren't on that, then they were going over to Buffy. And then it was so funny how David Fury was kind of part of their collective as well, and then he was on Lost for a season, then he jumped ship too to do other stuff. That they all kind of,
right,
if anything, it created their independence, it created their awareness of just being part of a collective. But it is also one of those, you know, unless you kind of wish they'd talk about it more often, you're just like, yeah, dude, I want to know about more of your stories when you first got into it. You know, I already know about what you've done since, you know.
Yeah.
And like you say, it's so hysterical, though, what stuff it's kind of crossed over with. I, as far as I'm concerned, even though the Picket Fences crossover never happened, I mean, since that's part of Chicago Hope, they did kind of reference it a lot on there, including
having. That would have been interesting to have that. And I do. That episode that resulted from that Red Museum is a personal favorite of mine. I think that's a really underrated episode. It would have been interesting if that had been a full fledged. absolutely. I mean, everybody talks about sort of these sort of top 25 or 30 that are very similar. But I mean, it shows 218 episodes. And if I didn't love, you know, most of them, I wouldn't love the show, you know, like I wouldn't love the show as much as I did if I didn't, enjoy most of those episodes. I wouldn't rewatch it, you know, as much. So, it's definitely worth talking about episodes that, that don't get as much attention, it tends to be big mythology episodes, a lot of the big comedy episodes. And as I said, episodes like Home that were sort of infamous get a lot of attention, but like, you know,
I think everyone hates on the super soldiers, but it's so funny now, kind of like with the new Star Trek, I'm seeing a lot of people hate on like the last two X-Files seasons, and I get it. You either like it or you don't like it, but
well, that's how all fandoms are. They're like, just like how all the Star Wars fans were like, they hated the prequels, but then when the sequel trilogy came out, now they like the prequels, you know, now they're, you know, like, oh, the prequels were real Star Wars, not like these stupid movies.
I'm totally getting that with
all fandoms are the same. All fandoms have the same issues that come up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing people.
So absolutely.
I remember people bashing the super soldiers, and I was kind of the same deal. I was like, well, not the greatest effects, but still kind of interesting. and Rocket and Ray's have kind of become fan favorites. So it's just interesting how those two Fed agents, they were kind of, again, just people just wanted to compare, even though they weren't even written at all like
Miller, Scully. No, I was a big fan of especially Doggett, both Doggett and Reyes. I think Robert Patrick and Annabeth Gish, they got so unfairly maligned during those last two seasons by fans who, you know, just couldn't accept anybody new. But I do think in recent years, they have, because I think they, the actors I'm talking about, I think they didn't think anybody liked them. I think in recent years, when we've had these like fan conventions that have popped up, they've gone to them and they've seen that they do have fans out there. And I think that's nice that they've seen that there actually were, the internet, you know, whatever you're talking about, whether it's culture or politics or whatever, the loudest voices in the room always dominate. So whoever's trashing something, whoever is, you know, like the worst
whoever
people,
does a bigger those are the people who contest. Stick out.
And those don't necessarily match up with, you know, the majority of fans. I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, it's nice for them to have gotten some renewed. And as you said, you know, because of people have had problems with the revival, they've gone back and been like, oh, yeah, seasons 8 and 9 weren't that bad. We really like those now. So you do have some of that effect as well. Season 8 is, I think, a really good season. Season 9, I still think I would probably rate it probably towards the bottom, but I do think it has some episodes, especially some of the standalone episodes like 4D or John Doe, Hellbound, Audrey Polly, Improbable Release. Those are some really good episodes. And it's like if those had Mulder and Scully, some of those would be considered classics, I think. So, you know, it's just people weren't paying attention as much because of, you know, David had left the show. And also 9/11 happened. People weren't really feeling the X-Files anymore.
That's what I noticed with every good show. Yeah. Like, and I don't even know how people got any kind of ratings going, because it just seemed like just about every other show just wasn't being watched as much.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's probably a fair point. I mean, I think
they kept it on, but then you just wouldn't know it because they're just constantly, you know, showing on TV. And I was always on, just kind of like, that's where I saw it with just any show, really. Just so many cable networks were just re-airing, you know, the network shows. And
right, it's
even funnier because then you realize how more violent it was than you were actually used to, because, you know, unless you stayed up late, you didn't really realize, oh yeah, this is still pretty edgy TV.
Yeah, I think seasons 8 and 9 were the first to have viewer discretion advice warnings since that home episode, because after the home episode, the censors really, you know, they bit down on the writers, and they kind of, you know, I wouldn't say neutered the show, but they said, yeah, you can't do any stuff like that anymore. But I think I think in those later seasons, when those people were paying attention again, I think they got away with maybe a little bit more. Maybe that's why it returned to some of its darker roots. So yeah, that's an interesting
point. It's like they want them to do it, and then at the same time they don't want them to do it.
The hypocrisy of censors is, I think, renowned, but, you know.
Yeah, it's like they're either afraid that someone will watch it or it's utter bullshit. It's, I mean, kind of the same with these other procedurals. It seemed like CSI was the only one that people bitched about briefly, but everyone was watching it, so they just stopped complaining.
Right, yeah. If it's a big enough hit,
I've never heard anyone complain about Criminal Minds. That's the weird thing. So I guess it was just that late enough a night, and again, like you say, kind of an X-Files kind of crowd.
Yeah, and I don't know how Hannibal was on NBC. Like, that show was
I saw people, and they somehow channels.
But I think they used the sort of X-Files tricks, and like they somehow got away with the horror because of like the artistic nature of it, and like the cinematography, and like tricks that they used from X-Files of Millennium. Yeah. They really got away with it. But yeah, that was a great show. I do miss that show as well. So
I guess because that show is popular enough, you know, it's already based off a pre-existing, you know, set of books, right, and a movie, that various movie versions, to where it had enough to just kind of already find its feet. But like you say, it is just like, it's never consistent when criticism goes down. But and half the time people just want to complain for the sake of complaining. But as another note, it is interesting how both Criminal Minds and X-Files will kind of take something that you could have sworn could have back in the day probably been a 70s, you know, drive-in scary feature or 80s slasher. Yeah. And they'll do something more with it. There's one episode, I don't recall which one, I'm actually going through it again because why not? But it's, there's like a sheriff who's like the head of a cannibal clan. I think it's a later episode. I'll name it now. I got the villain's wicket was a good help when researching. And I think it's Sheriff Ahrens, who is from the episode Our Town.
Okay, that's season two. Yeah,
right. More obscure one, but it was interesting how they kind of just, they already went there. It was so early in the run. Oh man.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, Fluke, again, you're talking about 218 episodes that there's so many topics broached on, you know, and I mean,
just that's the very show, image of Fluke Man just has that, you know, just, what is that thing, you know, this bandage?
Yeah, if we're talking about purest monsters, like, for me, the Fluke Man is the most iconic. I mean, he's the top. But I would say, like, I don't really consider Fluke Man a villain, though, because he's just sort of living his biology. You know, I can't really blame him for what he's doing. He doesn't really have any kind of moral calculus to what he's doing. So I think some of the monsters are more like that, whereas to me, like, the villains are more of the human that have powers, or
they do half the time kind of go for a universal monster appeal, where it's like, hey, I'm, or Godzilla approach is like, hey, I'm not trying to kill you, you're just in my turf, get out.
So as I said, I think pure monster, you know, Fluke, but I kind of feel sorry for Fluke Man. I mean, he didn't ask to be created in a nuclear ooze or something, so you know, he's got to go, but you know, he's not what I don't think he's evil, you know, he's just an animal. All right.
Fair enough. What do you think of Donald Faster?
Yeah, that's one of my top villains, like you said. And I know in the sequel episode, Orison, which I don't like, I actually don't like it because it suggests that he is an actual demon. And I think that takes away from the original episode, Irresistible, where he's meant to just be a serial killer. Like, that was the whole point of that episode, was that this is not a monster. He is a monster. He's barely human, but he is still a man who is this evil, without, you know, any kind of supernatural aspect. And of course, that's where Carter got the idea for Millennium to do more of those type of stories. But yeah, Irresistible is absolutely one of my top favorites. And Donald, he's played to perfection by Nick Chinlin. He's a perfect actor for that. And,
And just about every other actor has been on the show at one point or another. Brad Dourif was both villainous on X-Files and on Millennium. Tobin Bell was on one where he was like getting like roaches, I think, to kill people or some shit like that.
Yeah, I mean,
years before Saw. But Chinlin was the perfect pick. But I do agree. Even in lesser X-Files episode, I generally still like, but I do seem to recall that he did kind of, when they revisited the character, it just seemed like it had been too long, so the actors weren't just as fresh. Oh, that's right. The character we fought like 3 seasons ago.
Yeah, I agree with you. It wasn't,
I don't think they even had the same filmmakers or writers, so then it was just like,
Yeah, the sequels, also the sequel to Pusher is not very good as well.
Is that the one with Tombs?
The one with Tombs is a really good sequel. I actually like that more than Squeeze, the first episode.
What's funny is when you type in Pusher is the first thing that comes up in the X-Files episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Pusher is great. I mean, Pusher is also one of the best villains. I mean, because he's a man. He has obviously has special powers, but I mean, he's a sociopath. He's doing this because he likes, you know, controlling. He gets off on the power trip. Okay. And
I remember this now. Yeah.
You know, some people have pointed out that, you know, Mulder says something about him that, you know, he's a little man that wants to feel big. And people pointed out, you know, Vince Gilligan wrote that episode. People pointed out that that's sort of what Walter White is, you know, that sort of some of the other characters that Vince Gilligan created.
Oh,
Walter
yeah.
White from Breaking Bad is that he's a little man. He's a very diminished man who wants
and
to,
when you get
to feel
lone
big.
Gunman,
and
by that point, basically, Gilligan's trying out all his comedy that he later does on. What's that one procedural he did? That was a comedy show. Dean Winters and Josh Duhamel, Battle Creek. And so it's just so funny how
Right, yeah. I think that was based on, he didn't run that show, but it was based on a script he wrote. Cause Vince Gilligan, he wanted to be a movie writer. He had all these sort of movie scripts and he just sort of happened to get in X-Files and ended up having a TV career instead. But
right.
Yeah, and he does have some movie credits.
Well, dude, to be fair, he took a good chunk of those same writers who had written again for X-Files and Star Trek Enterprise and other B movies, and he just brought him along with him. He's like, you're coming with me. And one of those lead writers who was like the production assistant on I should say her name. She has a name, people, but yeah. She was like,
Jennifer Hutcheson. Is that who you're talking about?
Yes, actually. Yeah. And now she's one of the head writers on Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power. But yeah.
Right.
She's
the production assistant
on Saul and X-Files. These people who you don't know their names unless you're, again, you just got too much free time and you're on IMDb.
Right. Yeah, if you're like me, yeah. You know all the
but
background
it's just so
people.
Cool
but...
how. Is like they keep just coming around and you're just like, wow, yeah, they deserve to be working in here because this is their day job, and they don't just love what they do, they are also just so calculated and organized.
Yeah, I mean, those are the people who should be running shows, or people who have that kind of experience and background, you know.
There's plenty of people who don't grow as writers, and you're just like, hey, nothing personally, but I don't think you deserve your position. And other times, like maybe they did do a good job or a decent job, but the execution wasn't great, or I don't know.
Yeah, totally.
What do you think of, this is a later episode, I know this is again from season 9, what do you think of the Lord of the Flies main villain?
You know, I did watch that episode not too long. It's not one of my favorites, you know. It's although
I recall it being kind of like a Mustard Criminal Minds episode.
Yeah, I like lame, I mean, I like twist. That you know, I like Aaron Paul's in it. I mean, he actually got
even Jane Lynch is in it. Yeah.
Yeah, Jane Lynch is in it. I mean, she's, you know, she's good. Tom Schnoss, who wrote it, he went on to be like a really great writer for Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, like we're talking about. Like, so he, like a lot of these people, you know, they started there, and then, you know, some of them went on to really be much better writers and other things. Like John Scheiben is known for not being, you know, kind of hit and miss writer, I would say, on the X-Files, but you know, he wrote some of the worst episodes, but he also wrote some good ones.
Yeah.
People should recognize that. But
he's done some good Saul episodes.
But he's
too.
Like, he got an Emmy nomination for writing Ozark. I mean, so he's gone on to do
and that's just it too. I saw even these movies he did that were kind of grindhouse, kind of intentional, and they had a cool idea, but they just had the worst execution ever. And it was one of those where it's like, I'm sure there was a good idea and I'm sure he did his job, but somehow
I think the X-Files, you know, it was a hard show to write for. I mean, I think, you know, some people sort of got it and some people didn't, you know. There was a really revolving door of staff writers throughout the years, but other than outside of those main, you know, writers that worked many seasons, there were a lot of writers that came in and did like one episode or like two episodes maybe, and then for a season, and then they were gone because they just didn't work out. So, you know, I think it had the X-Files has like a very particular You know, I mean, it's interesting because it has a very particular voice, but also the other thing that's great about the show is that you had, you know, these different people come in and could put their stamp on it. Like Vince Gilligan has a very particular type of episodes that he does. And Darren Morgan obviously has these specific comedy episodes that he does. Yeah. So, I mean, that's why they all love working for Chris Carter so much, because he really let them go and do what they wanted, as long as it, you know, fit spot a certain pattern. Yeah, I mean,
Frank Spotnitz,
he was, yeah. Uh-huh. So,
so many other great shows he's worked on have not seen more than one season. You're like, why?
Yeah, he's, yeah, you know, like him and I mean, England Morgan too. They
not this shit on Chris Carter.
These one seasons,
but he kind of did take a back seat where he was just like managing people. He didn't really write as many episodes as, say, like, you know, pull a Dick Wolf or
yeah, he never wrote, like, David E. Kelly. He was never somebody who wrote every episode, but I mean, that's good.
Yeah, because J. Michael Straczynski or David E. Kelly would either come up with a story or write the first part of the season and then, like, leave it to the rest of
yeah.
the writers.
I mean, I think that was a good thing about Chris Carter, is he allowed other people to come in and do, and like, he sought out good talent.
It
and
also makes me wonder, why has he not been able to pitch anything else?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he, you know, after Harsh Rum, which I think was, you know, it was unfairly canceled, and then he did the After for Amazon. It was one of like the earliest Amazon shows, and like people actually voted on it to continue on. They wanted that. They actually voted to, like, that was the show they wanted to see more of, but there was just some disagreement between him and, like, Amazon wanted a show Bible, and Chris Carter does not do show Bibles. Like, he's anti, he does not do that. Or everybody knows that. So he
just can't tell people to do what yeah, he's just not going to do.
Yeah. So they parted ways on that. And then there were some other things that sort of bounced around until, including he did some sort of film called, there's, I guess, sort of semi autobiographical called Fence Walker, but it's not seen the light of day. This was before the X-Files revival. So yeah. And since the revival, he, you know, he really came back for that, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think he's older now and he doesn't quite have as much of the same stamina to do like TV shows, you know, all year round, like he used to. So, mm-hmm. So I don't know if he'd even be interested in doing it. I know when we went to the museum and heard him talk, he said he's writing a book about a swimmer or something. So, I mean, it's something totally different than the X-Files. So he might, maybe he's trying to write novels now, but I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, very nice. I guess I better talk about Grotesque.
Right.
The whole episode.
It's cool if we go off on tangents. It's totally fine.
No, I like it. I
interesting.
Yeah, well, and I did mean to see that Amazon pilot for the longest time that didn't get picked up. I think they removed it from the site.
I think you can find it on YouTube. I watched it not too long ago again, but oh, wow. You know, it's sort of interesting. It's like, I mean, again, what, you know, Chris Carter is a very prescient person. Like, he's always like, it was it was called The After, and it was about like the end of the world, and it really came out before, you know, all these end of the world shows started coming out, like The Walking Dead and now we have The Last of Us, which is a really good show so far. I'm really liking it, but yeah, he I think maybe he saw that was going to be on the horizon, that the shows about the breakdown of society and, mm-hmm. and everything. Because I think he talked after, like, every episode was going to be like basically a canto of Dante's Inferno. He had a pretty wild idea for it, but
that's awesome.
Yeah, I know. Like, you know, like, how did you not give us this show, Amazon? But anyway, you know,
totally. But yeah, no, with the Gargoyle episode, it is just interesting seeing, you know, Kurt Woodsmith, and we're going to talk about him later, is how he essentially just, you know, he gets to do a duo role. He's on, he's just, once again, they're back into the supernatural serial killer, that element, and then he's also playing a gargoyle. It's just like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, Grotesque, I think, is a I think it's one of those underrated episodes, not talked about enough. That's a very good episode. It's very creep, has a very creepy vibe to it, and really gets into obsession. And I think that's it was a really interesting exploration of how people can get too obsessed with, you know, again, it's one of these things that predate stuff that we would see later on, like this exploration of like, can criminal profilers get too obsessed with a serial killers and start to turn away from their humanity themselves? I mean, how many times have we seen that since? And, you know, the X-Files did something like that in season 3. So, you know, so much of what we watch today, you know, I can think about like, oh, there was an X-Files episode that was kind of like that, you know, see something. I mean, that was just what was just so great about watching the show was that it was so elastic. Every week was something different. You know, you never knew what to expect. You know, it could have been drama, comedy, sci-fi, thriller, you know, some experimental thing, you know, suddenly it's in black and white or it's in, you know, in real time, you know, something like that. So that was one of the thrilling. That's a big part of, I think, the show that people don't, because you ask people why the show is so great, people will usually say it's something about like the chemistry of David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, which is obviously a big part of it. And then obviously the 90s zeitgeist of aliens and, you know, but I think a big part of the show too was that week to week, you really, you know, you're watching a different movie every week.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
We're on all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
You know,
yeah, it's going to be
in terms of, you know, it could be completely different subject matter, but also the production value was so high. I mean, in early 90s TV was, you know, and still a lot of TV today is just people sitting around talking. You know, it's like lawyers sitting around talking, doctors sitting around talking, cops sitting around talking. But the X-Files, you watch that and there's a submarine conning tower coming up from the ice, you know, something, you know, it's just mind blowing stuff that. And you're just, you know,
I guess I better talk about the alien bounty hunters since he's in so many episodes.
Yeah, no, I think that's, yeah, he's a great villain.
There's so many B movie actors on the show who's like, they work really well. And it's not that they're bad actors. They just star in, you know, sometimes subpar, you know, made for TV director.
Well, right. And I mean, every actor, I mean, 99% of actors, they're lucky if they have one role that they can really do well. Or, I mean, I should put it another way, that they shine their particular talents in.
You don't know like what Brian Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that he's a bad actor, but it's just based on like his physicality and everything.
He was kind of a
certain types of roles.
Dolph Lundgren. Right.
And so, but he was perfect for the alien bounty hunter. He's menacing, but I mean, he's a good actor. So, I mean, in the times when he has dialogue and stuff, he's an engaging. You know, I don't really think, you know, we probably didn't get to hear the alien bounty hunter talk enough. I think they told him too much that, no, we just want you to be silent and menacing, which I think is fine. But
it's like, I think he only really growls when he's actually.
Yeah. But I think the scenes where he is, where he has some dialogue and he's talking, I think he's an engaging actor. And I would have liked to have seen more of that. He kind of diminishes over the series where you just don't. I think his early appearances are the best, and then later on he's just sort of there. But
talk about a traitor, you know, and
yeah,
most people just talk only about, like you say, Bounty Hunter or Cigarette Man. And don't get me wrong, they steal every show. I mean, Cigarette Man killed freaking JFK. I mean,
Or did he?
But, yeah, but
no, like, I mean, Krycek is of course perfect. I mean, he is somebody that you kind of love to hate. You love to get him, you know, he gets his ass kicked like all the time, but he's a survivor. You know, he's somebody, he's like the person who's always gonna he's like a cockroach or something, like he's always gonna survive it, you know, until you know, obviously he gets killed at some point. But I mean, he goes through so much, you know, just getting beaten all the time. He gets infected with the black oil, you know, he gets his arm cut off, you know, just they put him through the ringer, but he's always, you
even
know,
some of
the
creatures
the side,
played so. By stuntmen, you remember, because it's just very atmospheric, just design. You're just like, that doesn't look cheesy at all. That looks perfect. You know, there's reptiles.
No, yeah.
There's crocodiles.
I mean,
there's,
you know, and even with the HD remaster that's done, where you see a little bit more of, you know, like, you know, it's not quite as dark and grainy, so you know, you see a little bit more. I mean, it's still, most of it still holds up, you know.
The tension and everything. I mean, no one, people I notice who like to complain about just anything, like I find it amusing when I find a boom mic or an unconvincing stunt double in a shot, and it's like, well, because I have better eyes, we can see more than what we actually see,
right?
And
or like, you know, when they filmed it, they didn't anticipate that you'd be watching it in widescreen at someday.
Yeah,
so
the friend
you see
BuzzFeed,
I think it's Paperclip, ridiculous. Where if you look on the right, you see like a crew or something, there's like one scene, but that's because in season two they weren't yet shooting for widescreen. They didn't start doing that till season five. So of course, now that we're watching it, we're seeing some things that, you know, we weren't meant to see, you know. But
it's before digital, where you could correct it, you could see everything on the monitor. Sometimes, you know,
I don't get people who hate watch stuff. I don't get people who watch stuff to criticize.
I can understand
it, or
if
to
it's
find
an infamous movie,
to,
but yeah, if you're not
constructive, no,
and you're
gonna, I mean,
just
if you're
rant, then you're,
but that's
wasting
just
your time.
so many people in all kinds of fandoms, not just X-Files, but everything else, is like they exist more to be negative. And I just like, how, if I was negative about something, I wouldn't be a fan. I wouldn't devote my time to it. Like, why would I devote my any
that
of my time
sense.
Or life to do? Yeah. Right. No, and those people who have ruined. Yeah, exactly. CinemaSins, these other, you know, all these YouTube people who have ruined, you know, TV and film for, you know, generation. I mean, it's absurd. But yeah, not to get on another tangent, but I just can't imagine watching like the X-Files now and to
I know
to
people who have
it.
Really enjoyed some of the hammy acting in season one. I'm like, well, yeah, because this is how people acted back in the day. That's what they did.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing. It's like, you got to put yourself sort of in the time period that something, like, you
they
don't want to
kind
something...
of get away with it on some shows. They let actors ham it up on like an NCIS or SVU episode. It's like, it's just,
absolutely.
They can't help themselves. That's just,
I mean,
how the style is.
Procedural, yeah, I mean.
But that, it's way different compared to, say, I don't know, something trashy like, I don't know, Baywatch or Walker, Texas Ranger.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we've gotten used to this prestige TV era. So you sort of, if you're watching older stuff, you sort of have to put yourself in the mindset and time frame of that and judge it by, you know, I mean, you're not going to watch something from
so many people movie. Won't. And I'm like,
I mean, imagine people watching a film from the 1950s and judging it by today's standards.
There's many who do that, and I don't see the point.
Right, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah,
so. I see people who, I mean, we were talking about TV pilots. I see people who will only treat it like a TV pilot. And it's like, I don't know. Some of these are decent as a simple 45, 90 minute ordeal.
Yeah,
but if you're just going to be disappointed by what could have been or how it's unfinished, then you're just not going to get anywhere. It's just appreciate what does work. It's like, yeah, I would have liked to have seen this.
I think that like the X-Files pilot absolutely still holds up, and the Millennium pilot is amazing. I mean, it's I think
the
it's
pilot a great does get you in the mood. It's kind of more cutesy, but I don't know. I've introduced it to some people and they haven't given it a chance. And there's others who is like, okay, interesting. I think it's all made up for in that last 5 minutes where you see again, you know, Sigmen going in the back and
right
pulling out a capsule, and it's just so unfathomable. It's just like, how did this featured extra, you know, how did they decide midway through that he was going to be the main baddie? Is I just can't fathom him not being the main baddie, because it's just, and we're so used to it. And when you just learn
well,
that,
you know, and some people will, you know, again, we're talking about people who are endlessly negative, but some people will act like, oh well, if like this wasn't planned, so you don't get any credit for this. Like, no, a great TV producer takes advantage of what he's given. So if you're casting someone as an extra, but here comes William B. Davis and he exudes this gravitas that makes you expand that role, it's the eye of a TV producer to see that and take it. It doesn't say anything against, you know, just because it wasn't all planned. You know, there's just this idea out there that like everything must be planned, and if it wasn't planned, then it's not good. And like, no, like the vast majority of things that we watch and enjoy are not planned out. You know, like nowadays, TV seasons are, you know, a lot of them are written, you know, all the scripts are written before they start filming. Like, that's different. But I mean, you know, the whole series isn't planned out, or like all the, they're still taking advantage of things that they see.
You have to improvise a little bit. You have an outline, but when you find that, oh, this person's really good as this character, we need to have more of said character, and you need to kind of just have a backup. A lot of people don't do a backup. And so when a character leaves, then it's like, well, our show's kind of dying because it's just not the same oomph.
Yeah, I mean, I think a combination of taking advantage of, you know, spontaneous things that happen, but also keeping track of continuity is probably the best.
You need those
X-Files didn't really keep, you know, they didn't keep a show. You know, I don't think everything needs to be planned out. In fact, I think that that's probably a bad thing. But I think that, you know, as you're going, you know, keeping that's what they did on. That's how Vince Gilligan, I think, learned from the experience and to going towards Breaking Bad, was he didn't have everything planned out for five seasons. Not at all, but they kept tremendous track of the continuity to make sure everything would line up, you know, in the end. So like, I think that's what,
it's pretty much whoever wins the writer's room. And so many people want to give just one or five people a credit. And it's like, there's all these other guys who, I mean,
that does annoy me too as well. I usually point out, because a lot of people will say like, well, Vince, you know, same thing, like Vince Gilligan,
or he only wrote one episode. He wasn't there involved. Yes, he was.
Yeah, there are a lot of a lot of great writers that contributed to Breaking Bad, especially Better Call Saul. Like, Vince Gilligan wasn't even as involved in that one, but so you know, you got to give credit to everybody.
Well, actually, I didn't know that, but.
He left. Peter Gould was the
main guy,
the EP on that, for most of it, and Vince, I think, left for a couple of seasons. He came back for the final season, but he just wasn't as involved with Breaking Bad was more of his personal baby. But I mean, even with Breaking Bad, that was a writer's room. Everybody together broke the episodes. And then, you know, it's very different than X-Files, where everybody broke and wrote their own episode, you know, and then Chris Carter or somebody else would rewrite the scripts. But, you know, the way the X-Files writer room was very different than how writer's rooms are now, where like all the writers sit together, they break down every single scene, and then they assign who's going to write the specific script. You know, and the way we did it for our virtual season, we did it the old fashioned way, where, you know, we did talk together about our ideas and stuff, but like I did my episodes and the other writers did their episodes, and you know, it all gelled in the end. But I mean, we did it because the other writers were mainly working on like the standalone episodes anyway. So they, you know, I mean, when you have a show that's based around standalones, it's a lot easier to have writers who can just do specific things versus a show that's serialized. Obviously, you need to have all the writers together, you know, planning everything out. But it just depends on sort of what kind of series you're doing.
Totally. Fortunately, most of it gelled for the most part. It helped that they would bring back some of the same filmmakers so they could at least deliver the same tone and shots, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another thing, you know, people started paying attention to who was directing the show.
I mean, sometimes you don't remember Rob Bowman. You just remember the villain.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a crime that Rob Bowman did not go on to be a big Hollywood film director, because he is an amazing director. I mean,
he got to do the movies, so that was cool. But yeah.
But I mean, he should have gotten to do more
than just TV,
more movies. Yeah. But because he is a great movie eye. But I mean, obviously Kim Manners, David Nutter,
rest in peace, Kim.
Yeah. So they, you know, again, and I think with everybody, I mean, people know who Mark Snow is, what other TV show do you know who does the music, you know, for the show? Like, but because the music for the X-Files stood out so much, people know like who the composer is. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, again, it's just because the X-Files, there's not one answer to why it's great. I mean, it's a bunch of different things working together, and they just all happen. Everything just happened to sync up and and work for the show. And it's just, you know, it's a once in a lifetime sort of thing that happens. But one of the other villains I wanted to bring up was the Roach from Paper Hearts. He's the like child killer that's in the episode.
Yeah, John
played by Roach. Tom Noonan. He's mm-hmm. he's
RoboCop
Tom Noonan
too.
Is absolutely creepy as hell in that episode, and he
has a big body count. They mentioned he's killed like hundreds.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really get worse than more evil than, you know, a child killer, and he just has absolutely no remorse or no, you know. So in that episode,
I'm glad you mentioned him. I was thinking of bringing him up.
He's absolutely one of my favorite performances in the show as well. And I think that episode is really well beloved, but I don't know if his particular part in it is as so I think he is an actor, and that character are a bit maybe underrated or underappreciated compared to some of the others.
Him and Oral Petey, played by Billy Drago, are kind of the voodoo guy.
Yeah, Thief was another one that I kind of had on my list here.
I think people had left the show by then, or they just weren't paying as much attention. But that's just it. It's like, I'm okay with if they didn't put as much attention into the episode because the villain was just so kick-ass.
I know with that episode, they wanted to have a villain that sort of had a point, and that, you know, that modern medicine or whatever killed his daughter, so he was, you know, using his his magic abilities to take revenge and so I think that he is a little bit more of a sympathetic edge to him. Another one I wanted to bring up was Virgil Encanto from the episode Too Shy. And he's like the fat vampire, that's kind of what people call them. He is, I mean, he's a mutant like Tombs, and
that's
he's living his biology, but he also lures his victims by romancing them and making these, you know, vulnerable women, you know, feel like he loves them. And that's a very
very sick and twisted. Kills.
Yeah. And, you know, Scully gets a great scene with him at the end of the episode where, you know, she tells him that he's trash. But it's, you know, he's a sort of an underrated villain, I would say, because he is manipulating people emotionally.
I'm glad you thought of him. I mainly remember the actor, but yeah, he did have a name, and it was just cool because just the way he's just buttoning his suit, he's just no troubles, just brewing.
Right.
Him and Rob Roberts is interesting. It's the deformed killer. He loves to eat brains.
Yeah. I'll bring up somebody from the revival since we're talking about eating people. Barbara Beaumont, Barbara Beaumont from the second to last episode of the show, Nothing Lasts Forever. She's a sort of a a vampire, but they're eating people to stay young. And she's like a failed TV actress, but she wants to stay young. Yeah, she's played to perfection by Fiona Vroom, I think is the actress's name.
I know that
yeah, she's really good. Yeah, I think
I do remember that. Yeah, that
episode. I wanted to get somebody from the revival in there, but
him and the guy from Flight of the Conchords, who was like the guy who morphed into like a werewolf, was kind of funny. He was a con.
Oh, right. What's his name?
Beaumont, didn't get enough love because I guess everyone was so distracted by the main arc of Will Mulder and Scully find their kid. And that, along with the drones, were just kind of out there, but they can be appreciated. I don't know about the drones, but you can definitely appreciate,
the van. It's not one of my favorite episodes, but her performance in it is really good. She stood out in that one.
And you bought into it. It's like, I'm an actress who wants to, get my looks back by feeding on this blood. That unusual agenda that works for her. It makes you wonder half the time about these characters' biological, origins and everything. Yeah. And if you're going to talk, the return, I found it interesting how, you talked about the Peacock family earlier, how Karen Cannavale, returned a few different times. And I remember one, she played this one crazy gal who was like flinging feces matter in the ward.
Right. Well, she plays four different characters in that episode because she plays twin, like a male and female twin, but they're crazy and have like a dual, both have dual personalities. Yeah, that was a really great episode of the revival.
1000%.
But I'm glad she's amazing. I mean obviously people loved her from as Mrs. Peacock, but they didn't really know who the actress was until she did that in the episode's called Plus One.
She's still an underrated Canadian gal. She's been on Continuum.
She's
in a hysterical Snowpiercer. She's good on, but she's in a Hysterical Psych episode, ironically also set in like a psych ward or Vacation Place or some shit like that.
And she seems like a really sweet person. It's like in any interview she's
like
done.
Many of these Canadian guys is just like they've been working for years and they're okay if it gets to their sixth stage of their career and they're finally going to a convention and recognized by
audience. And she I think she's gonna be at the, I mentioned the X-Files Museum, but I think she's gonna be at the summer fan event that I think they have announced it. I think she was the first guest they announced. So
What do you think of the Beggarman who was played by that
Indian actor.
It's another
episode. Again, we're talking John Scheiben episodes, which you can love or hate, but
I recall that it episode being awkward,
it's not good, but I enjoy it. It has like this really B movie horror aspect.
That's kind of why I liked it. It was
just, and yes, I mean obviously you got this the beggar on the squeaky cart going around. Yeah, that's Deep Roy, the actor.
There's some episodes really I really remember the commercials more than I remember the episodes. And don't get me wrong, I'll go through them again. One episode, like I think one of the freakiest promos I saw, and I hadn't even seen the episode, was the Bark Creatures one.
I had some. I told my friends I was going on this podcast, and I was like, what are your favorite villains or whatever? And somebody wanted me to bring those up because
just the whole idea is just creatures blend in with a bark of a tree.
Well, and they're like monsters, but they sort of have a point. Like humans are encroaching on their habitat, destroying the environment. So they're trying to get them out of it. Yeah, I mean, so I think those are interesting. I think the cult from the episode Roadrunners, I don't know if you remember that one, but it's in season 8. And
is that the one with Michael Massey from The Crow? He's playing like a Jim Jones type.
No, that's The Field Where I Died in season 5.
Yeah,
but
that's another one where people complain.
Roadrunners in season 8, that's it's an episode where Scully goes to this really desolate town, and there's this cult that's trying to put this like banana slug type creature inside her.
Yes.
Yes, and that's that's a really good episode.
I saw it, but I don't really
But the cult is extremely creepy. The idea that they're like religious fanatics and they think this creature is like the second coming of Christ, and they're putting it in human hosts.
They don't have so many of those, especially on Millennium.
So that one's those are some interesting people. Let me see. And
some of these episodes we brought up have been like reviewed as some of the worst, and it's just like, I don't know what they're talking about. It's not something I regret watching. But yeah, I think
some episodes maybe they weren't great, but like you're saying, like the squeaky cart guy, that's a memorable episode, even if it wasn't that good. So I mean,
it'll take it over any overrated movie franchise where people have spoiled.
And then if you're basically if you're past season 5, you're going to have a pool of fans who don't like something, because that was like the point at which people started not liking, you know, certain corners of the fandom started not liking the show after the first movie. So
I've even done it with Criminal Minds, where I'm like, I don't remember the villain as much as the show goes on, but the way better season compared to those two lesser seasons. You know,
No, I mean, I like season 6 okay. I mean, I think it has some issues. Season 7, I'm not big on, but I think like season 8 is sort of rejuvenation for the show when you have Doggett come in and it has the mythology sort of bigger. They also they were in LA, but they sort of went back to darker episodes instead of
if
the
someone's
going to
ship the fan, it better just not leave too here, just stink, you know, like, or it better be just minor where it's a big nitpick. Like, I mean, we're talking Star Trek.
Yeah.
But it better not be like where, you know, Troy and Worf randomly fall in love and there was no foreshadowing of that, you know.
Right, yeah, that's sort of
it's
odd.
Just weird.
Right.
But the rest of the episodes are so good, you don't really think about that subplot that doesn't work, you know. And the reason,
well, the thing is, people think, you know, again, that's another one, people have this sort of vision about like the stuff they grew up with as kids or the stuff they saw that turned them into fans, where they like they won't go back and they won't sort of critically review that in the same way that they do stuff now. I'm like, you can't tell me that any current Star Trek show isn't better than season 1 of Next Generation, which is like one of the worst seasons of TV, you know? Yeah, I mean, like, you can't tell me that, you know, and I don't like all the new Star Trek stuff either. I'm just saying that all of that stuff is higher quality than a lot
I've
of
actually
crap
gotten into, like,
that we
Discovery
watched when we were young.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, I've liked Discovery better as it's gone along, and I've seen other people, they just will not watch it. I'm like, well, I mean, that's okay if you don't like it, but I mean, all of them have a rough first season. Even, you know, Voyager is considered to be probably one of the best that has a good first season, but, you know, not every show is going to be firing all cylinders, but I mean, there's a reason we all come back to it, is because there's so much to just take away. So
Star Trek was, you know, infamous for that, where like the first season was going to be bad and you had to wait to, but I mean, imagine like that wouldn't even happen today. Like if you had a first season that's bad, you wouldn't get a season 2. But like that was back in the days when you could have time to build an audience, and you could have time to, like, your whole first season basically sucked, and you know, by God, you shouldn't get another one. But then, you know, Next Generation comes back, season 2, and like the first episode's instantly better. You know,
we didn't have the eject, you know, or switch off with the remote.
Wouldn't give anything that much time, or certainly networks wouldn't. You know, Netflix and stuff certainly wouldn't give anything. Netflix won't even renew stuff that's good in its first season. So it's amazing.
Just like ratings don't really mean anything, or people have already given up looking at Rotten Tomatoes.
The streamer model, the subscriber model, is really just not working out for content, long term content. But that's another podcast, probably. It's a whole nother discussion we could probably do on that. But I'll bring up somebody from season 9, since it gets crapped on. But Lukash, who is he's a serial killer that goes back and forth between dimensions, so he can't be tracked.
I think so.
And he's in the episode 4D. He's actually he's a pretty particularly creepy serial killer as well.
Special set of skills. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a really good episode. That's 4D is one. If that had been Mulder and Scully and not Doggett and Reyes, that would probably be considered a top classic episode of the show. But again, people weren't willing to give it that you know, chance, because it wasn't their favorite people there. But you know, this is something that sticks with me, because I am somebody who literally watched the show from its US premiere, like, you know, It's September 1993. I'm like, if I can give these new characters a chance in season 8 and 9, you should have been able to do that too. But the Phantom, just like most Phantoms, get so toxic.
Oh, and
they
it didn't
just
get win an so... Emmy. It doesn't have to win an Emmy.
Right. It's depressing. So I actually started my own X-Files Facebook group on Facebook because
nice.
I got sort of, it's called We Still Want to Believe, if anybody wants to join it. But I just got tired of a lot of the toxic groups that, you know, where like all they would post is pictures of Gillian Anderson. I'm like, I love Gillian Anderson too, but if we can talk about the show, it's not just, mm-hmm. it's not just she's hot. So, you know,
there was that or... Like you say, people want to have a closed-minded chat or and it's just always just annoying because you're just like, can you please stop?
So, you know, if you're cool, you can join that group. We can have some good discussions. But I think that was I did the episode Chimera from season 7 has a sort of interesting villain. It's a woman. She's like a housewife. She's in a happy marriage, and she ends up being like the sort of Jekyll and Hyde again? Monster Chimera. I think it's how you. And it's a late season 7 episode, but it's not one of the best. But it has an interesting villain because she's a woman who's sort of like this housewife, and she like her husband is stepping out on her, and she's just like in this unhappy place, and. Her mental instability, I guess, takes physical form, and she ends up becoming, she has like multiple personalities, and like one of those personalities, it's sort of like we saw the film later, the M. Night Shyamalan did Split, where the guy has multiple personalities and one of them's a monster.
Again,
X-Files, this episode kind of did that first. But I think it's sort of interesting because she's sort of, I wouldn't say she's a Karen, but I mean, she's just sort of like, you know, it kind of gets towards that, you know, a little bit again, presage that thing. But I think that, you know, the idea that she's becoming a literal monster, because of this stuff is sort of interesting. But again, that's another episode. So we should talk about episodes that people don't talk about all the time.
It makes you wonder that's
you one
know, you brought up Shyamalan, how many of him or the Blumhouse guys would probably fare better if they did a Twilight Zone or X-Files show where there's a little less control, I mean, and they just do the eye-catching, you know, opening, you know.
Yeah,
because we're just so guys, corporate nowadays. Yeah.
Some guys I know that are definitely X-Files fans. I don't know if you've heard of them, but these filmmakers, I think Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson, I want to say.
Yeah, that
you know them. Yeah,
traction.
Yeah, they. I've really enjoyed their films, and like they're really unique. They've put together
just
like,
about any movie definitely be a good Twilight Zone X-Files episode. And
so,
in a way, I feel like this show pays tribute to those same kinds of indie filmmakers. I mean. Whether it's obscure video nasty like Dead and Buried or Nightmare on Elm Street type knockoff movies that always had those kind of a feel. Where
it could be... I mean, and for sure, you know, there are episodes of The X-Files that are like homages to movies and stuff that came you know, Ice is, you know, basically the thing. And, you know, I mean, totally Beyond the Sea is kind of like Silence of the Lambs. I mean, it's, you know, it's a similar setup.
That's why they made Millennium. They wanted a Silence of the Lambs 7
time
show that happened to and I mean if I do have to throw out some Millennium villains here. I gotta bring up Lucy Butler.
Oh sure.
Who's the shape-shifting demon who just continually will just play mind games with Frank.
Right.
Until he just kind of cancels her out. He just stops thinking about her.
Sarah Jane Redmond, the actress, she's amazing.
Another great Canadian actress. She's been everything. You know.
And, you know, that was back when, you know, you didn't really see as many women in prominent roles or like villain roles. So it was sort of unique to have sort of, you know, one of the main villains of that show be a woman or like whatever she was a demon or something. But.
Right.
Yeah, she's a great part of that show. Yeah,
very rarely, I think only past season 1, you know, did they ever have anything that was just like, okay, I'm a succubus or a vampire and I'm going to kill you.
Right.
They went beyond that and gave them all, like you say, just strong characters who, you know, we know what their wants and needs are.
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I had to bring up Michael Massey because, you know, just all those cult leaders, Jim Jones inspired villains were great. Obviously, you know, Terry O'Quinn's, shadowy government guy on Millennium was good because, you know, the dude has made a living just playing shitheads, you know.
Yeah.
And like Krycek, same kind of arc as Peter Watts. He's just the whole, I answer to these guys. And I do seriously think, you know, the stepfather actor had it gone on longer, he might have, they might have connected him to Cancer Man, because I mean, they did it with Jose Chong, which is a standard for Scientology, you know, made appearances on both shows.
He's mentioned
on X-Files, and then he actually appears on Millennium, actually, you know, convincing people to kill themselves or do murder suicides.
Yeah, I think if Millennium had gone on, they probably would have done some more. You know, I mean, I think they were wise to not do that at first, even though it would, you know, even though, I mean, or it even though it been, probably would have been good for ratings, like creatively, I think, to not have, you know, Mulder and Scully in the first episode of Millennium or something.
Oh, totally. I've seen people who, you know, are X-Files heads, but have never seen those other ones because they just were never, the DVDs sold out pretty fast FX. My pal Erica chimed in and told me how she, would see it, but it was like morning hours of, you know, FX. It's kind of like Trilogy of Terror. They were afraid to re-air it. It's so freaky.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Blurring that line between PG-13 and R.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, but, you know, again, they sort of got away with it by being visions and like they could do really quick flashes of the horror. So it didn't, now, you know,
we can't go a single network show without seeing someone get shot in the head or.
Right. Yeah. It's all over the place now. It's much more. People are much more desensitized to that stuff.
Yeah.
Now.
Some of them. It's interesting is like it this. I'm just like, this could be a PG-13 movie because it's medical violence, but then there's other ones like, yeah, no, this is too much. if it wasn't showing at midnight. And it's the same thing with a video game. Why does how the graphics are done determine whether it gets a T or an M rating? But like you say, I like how you did Illusions. Is like there are some episodes. It's like you don't have to, even if they had said, "Oh, it's not a knockoff." It's like, yeah, well, it's pretty inspired.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, because they're trying to put out. They were putting out. I mean, it's really insane to think how much they put out because those early seasons were like 24. Season 2 is 25 episodes long. The later ones are like more of what was the standard 22. But I mean, nowadays they make 10 episodes. They make. You know, if that, and just they were doing that every year. I mean, it's kind of like the first two seasons of the X-Files is as many episodes as a show now gets in its entire life, and that's just kind of crazy to think how much they and so much of it was good. I mean, like so. I mean, yeah, there are crappy episodes. There are some filler episodes, but the vast majority of the shows are of the X-Files episodes are at least enjoyable, and then obviously there are many of them that are very good and great. So it's, that's why it's still another reason it still stands up because the quality is so high.
I wish there was kind of more villains on like the Lone Gunman, but in all fairness, that's more of a, you know, comedic, you know, heist spy show, you know?
Yeah.
I wish they could,
you know, I think it was a wise, I think having Morris Fletcher on at the end was a wise choice to sort of, I think they were going to make him the sort of main villain of the show, but of course it didn't go on from there, but yeah, I think the Lone Gunman, to me, it was a little too comedic. I think that, you know, they just leaned very heavily into that. And it was also just wasn't really funny comedy. So that was the problem. But
It's kind of more I think, goofy in just essence, but not.
I think I see what they were going for. I mean, I remember reading an article that was like, oh, this is kind of in the mold of F Troop or like some of those classic shows that are like goofball show. But I'm like. Yeah, but you know, I think they could have been. I think towards the end of the Lone Gunman series, they started to get it a little right where it was like it was still kind of lighthearted, but it was a little bit more serious and it wasn't as goofy. I think they started to, you know, of course, just by then it was too late, but you know,
yeah,
no, also, it just you know, the. You know, the time to do a spinoff of the X-Files would have been like season 5 at like the height of the show. Like that's when they, you know, doing it in season 8 when you already had people questioning whether they still even wanted to watch it. I think, Fox just sort of, they approved that spinoff because they didn't know if X-Files would continue, because at that point it was up in the air with Duchovny and all that. But, it's just one of the things that happens, if people are much more willing now to like give things a specific shelf life, like, okay, this is going to be a final season. And like, that didn't happen back in the 90s. It's like, you did it until the horse was absolutely beaten, and then you got canceled because of low ratings. Like, that's that's how it happened.
And we've proven it wrong time and again, how everyone thinks, oh, you can't transition. It's like, no, some stuff really does, work better in a different, dilemma, a different predicament, versus this and that. And I think even just so many movies going to TV and then vice versa, TV shows become movie franchises, it serves everybody. And Ash versus Evil Dead was a good example. So many fans want more. I still want more. And at the same time, it just wasn't meant to be, unfortunately, because the network guys just had a BS excuse. They had like different vice presidents of programming. I hate that too, where it's like they don't want anything that the last administration had. And it's like, you don't have to have this be political, like presidential stuff. We got to clean out our cabinet and fire everybody.
Oh yeah, that's just awful. Like, yeah, it was like the stuff that happened with Warner Brothers Discovery and then like the DC. So yeah, it's just awful that all this stuff's getting wiped away because new people are coming in. And I think they're going to find out that that's not going to work for them. But with the X-Files, a part of me is always going to want more, because of course I'm going to miss it, and I do miss it. But I mean, at the end, I'm like, they had 25, total of 25 years. And at some point you gotta leave it. And, I was fine with how it ended. I know a lot of fans aren't, but I mean, I think it made sense for the characters to give them like some sort of happiness again. Like, if they have another baby, a chance for life, and just to leave it there. Like, we don't need to bring them back and then they're in trouble again. And like, if the X-Files is going to come back at any point, I think, it's going to be a reboot, or it's going to be a fresh take on it, and I think that's people need to give that, and people need to understand, like, okay, maybe it's not for you. Maybe it's for a new generation of fans that will rise up, for it. Like, old fans are always like, it needs to be for me. Like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. You had your show. Like, we had our show that we'll love, and we'll love it forever. But that doesn't mean the X-Files can't come back at some point and be a show that, people that are the age that I was or you were when we started watching it, and they'll fall in love with it, and that, like, that can be a great thing. People just they can't get that in their heads and separate those things. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be for the original fans. It can be for a new, and like, that's, if I were to suggest to anybody, if somebody like, what should they do with the X-Files, I would be like, I would wait a few more years, but I would be like, then you should redo it, and you should bring in fresh perspectives and gear it towards an audience of today.
They did that with those agents and even maybe Rogers characters, but like, they didn't get any fanfare, so they just
you're talking about the Miller and Einstein season. That was I don't know what they were doing with that. That wasn't gonna work. But I think, it just needs to be a friend. I mean, I think they can even at some point just recast Mulder and Scully. I mean, it worked for Star Trek. I mean, it worked. Nobody ever would have thought that they'd be able to recast Kirk and Spock, but they did it, and it worked. Maybe. And it made Star Trek popular again. Like, nobody could believe that after Enterprise just died.
It's weird which characters were okay with the different versions and other times, like, no, I can't touch it. Like, I don't. For instance,
right now I can't imagine it, but I mean, in a few more years,
I think you should just, I'll go with your earlier one, maybe just different agents.
It could be that too. I mean, it doesn't,
mentored by Frank Black
or company. right. I mean, yeah, and I I would love, I know Chris Curtis talked about there's going to, somebody's writing a book that's like a continuation of the show right now. So that'll be interesting if we that see that. Sense. And he's, so
many people have done comics and everything.
Yeah. So and he's himself, I think he's trying to pitch a revival or something of Millennium, which would be really cool. I mean, I don't think Lance can be like, I mean, I would love Lance to be in it, but I think like to me, it needs to be new agents, you know, it needs to be like his daughter or somebody who's the lead. And then Frank is like, you know, an advisor, you know, Lance Henriksen's 80 years old. I mean, he's amazing.
There you go.
He's 80 years old. He can't
in hiding. And they,
right.
When they find him, the show ends. Like,
yeah, I mean,
the search, you know, for Frank Black,
however you want to do it. Yeah. But yeah, I think it would be interesting because certainly the stuff with Millennium, you know, it's like some of the things like Millennium feels more appropriate to today than it did in the late 90s, because I mean in the late 90s obviously there was a lot of anxiety about the Millennium, but the year 2000 and stuff, but and then of course that the world did change like in 2001 with 9/11, and then since then it's like been one disaster after another. right, yeah, there you go. And then the X-Files revival kind of predicted COVID to some extent, you know.
They really did, and they didn't need to. It's just they've had ideas, because
it's kind of funny because like a lot of the conspiracy weirdos and stuff out there they're going back and they're watching those episodes now, and they're like, oh, mm-hmm. this is predictive programming, you know, and they're or whatever. But so that's kind of amusing, but I think that just speaks to how the show is. It always, you know, Chris Carter had his ear to the ground, and he hears stuff and he knows people, and he knows, you know, people, like, you know, he'd ask like what are the things that keep you up at night, and people would be like, well, like a pandemic, you know. That's like something that, although there were movies and stuff like what was the Contagion that had been done exploring right, that as well before, but and a lot of the things they called, you know, very well, like the idea that you would have people like you know, Alex Jones or something, say, you know, Hawking.
That was a good
cure, touch, you know,
having the right guy be on there as the conspiracy theorist. I mean, and
yeah,
so, just about every other show has some social commentary. It's just so annoying when you encounter people, I don't like social commentary. I'm like, well, it's going to be in there regardless of how evident it is, regardless. So,
right. I mean,
go somewhere else if you want mindless entertainment.
Yeah. And the thing is about those people is that they think that the stuff they grew up with didn't have that stuff, but it did. They just didn't realize it because they were kids. You know, they didn't realize when they, and now they watch stuff as adults and like, oh, I don't like it because it's political. I'm like, well, no, but it's the same as when you were a kid. You just didn't get it. You get it now, though. Yeah. So, you know, people are silly.
They really are.
That's my takeaway. But no, I think, again, that's something great about the X-Files is just that it predicted so much. Just, you know, I know it introduced me to a lot of things that I didn't know. You know, I learned a lot of words because of episode titles that were, you know, I learned Latin words because of the X-Files. I learned about things in history that you don't hear in school, like Operation Paperclip. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of these, the more nefarious things that have been done in history that you just don't care about. When
that in Battlestar Galactica kind of made me just do the whole, just, you know, pay more intensely, you know. Intense attention, yeah, I call it.
No,
and not just attention, intense attention.
Yeah, actually one of my friends, she's starting to watch Battlestar Galactica, and I told her, I'm like, you know, she's like 10 years younger than me, but so I don't know how much she remembers of the time when that show was on, but I said, you should keep in mind watching that, like what was going on in politics during that era, like when George Bush was president, the war on terrorism is going on, because all of that stuff.
Who saw that? I actually asked some family the other day, is like, did you ever get the 9/11 illusions from Battlestar and Enterprise? Because, you know, I looked up, I kind of got that illusion anytime anyone would pull a patriotic card.
Right.
And everyone else was like, no, and I just didn't think of it.
A lot of stuff really just flies over people's heads. I mean,
they just seem like to that. Think it, there has to be a flag waved or
exactly like trumpet they,
plays.
Like, and, you know,
it has to be or something campy or unintentionally over the top.
And I'm like, yeah, like the Rambo, the vast majority of what we watch is like is reflecting popular times in some way. But yeah, they miss that. But I'm like, if you I didn't watch Battlestar Galactica when I was on, but I watched it when it was repeated a few years later, like on BBC America or something. Sweet. But I mean, I watched it and I was and certainly I saw all the things that, you know, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. And they were doing this, you know, during a time when, you know, people really didn't want you to talk about certain things. But
if it's in a sci-fi or a crime template, then it's all good.
But that's always been the great thing about sci-fi, right? Is that sci-fi allows you to talk about things in ways in that horror, people don't. Yeah, or in horror is another one. Allows you to talk about political themes and social themes in imagine ways that people Scully, won't object to. Yeah.
Can you imagine Scully and Mulder in, like, say, the universe of something like, you know, the allusion to slavery and Candyman or religious terror like Hellraiser or even Alien and Predator is how.
Mm-hmm.
Battlestar and even Planet of the Apes, I have to tell people, is like, that's not just a mindless, you know, killing cyborgs or...
like that is a long tradition in sci-fi, is to be allegorical and to be going back to, you know,
it's the old trick
on TV, book. Twilight Zone, but in books way before that with H.G. Wells and all, you know, Jules Verne and all
even
those
with
people.
Podcasts, I think people are now appreciating radio dramas now.
Yeah, but I mean,
years ago absolutely. They thought, oh, my great granddad listens to that, it drives me crazy.
Right.
And just, I mean, actually,
they don't remember because as kids, you don't know what's going on. So you don't realize that the stuff you're watching has meaning and subtext. Mm-hmm. And then you watch it as an adult. And then I guess some people get that it does now. And then some people are like, no, the things I watched were political free and everything's political now. Like, no, you're.
Or because I couldn't figure out
just don't get
it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, well, I mean, you think about how imagine Aliens coming out now, where you have Ripley, where you have a strong female lead, like now it would be seen by all these people as
these toxic guys.
These toxic guys. Now it would be seen as, oh, this is woke because they're putting in a strong female.
I'm
like, this
was
the 1980s. Nobody cared other than this was an awesome character that kicked ass.
That's
and
I
you
think
thought
the
same thing, and your only reason you think differently now is because a couple of morons on YouTube tell you to think differently, and you know. So again, another tangent.
And I get tired of the whole. Yeah, I don't see anyone complaining about Scully or how dumb
exactly.
Can be at
that
times.
Would be another.
And it's
that
just
would
like
be another thing. You know,
it's like people, like you say, don't want enough development, or they want it to be simple, and it's like, and then they complain if it's formulaic. I'm like, well, because you asked that to be simple and or not serialized.
Right.
But yeah, it is annoying how there are just so many. Is like I've been losing track of toxic guys who go, I'm a feminist. I'm like, clearly not. if you had an actual valid reason, like I just don't care for the actor, I don't find them believable, I'm like, well, okay, so there, good, Timmy learned how to use his words, you know, instead of
exactly.
Jackass saying it's like, then just say that. Yeah. Don't say it's the worst thing since, you know, I don't know, whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's ridiculous, but you know, it just, again, like we said at the beginning, all these voices get amplified because of social media.
These guys are aliens to us.
Yeah, pretty. They might as well be. You know, the aliens can come take them and take them somewhere else. That would be great. But
all right, and to close out the villains of the X-Files saga, I once again have another wonderful guest. I have Nicole Neese from the X-Files Fanfic Exchange on Twitter. Welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Absolutely, and so much like many of the various movies and shows, we had reopened it and we were just like, you know, all of us want to talk about different things, but not all of us are going to get on the same panel. So it's like most everybody wanted to do Alien, Predator, Lord of the Rings, Breaking Bad, Star Trek. I was like, well, but let's angle the conversation a bit. So it's not just five different, you know, season reviews of something, or it's like,
yeah, 20 different franchises at once,
right? It's like, okay, well, let's examine what I know we could talk about. What are the best moments? What are the best villains? And we're doing the latter, at least with this case, because we already went with the best moments. We had the X-Files fan retrospect Duo on, and as well as a bunch of others. And that was pretty much, hey, we got a bunch of moments to pick from Scully and Mulder's various shocks to the submarine episode to all other sorts of gripping moments. So I was just like, yeah, but it's so if there's anything that makes for a compelling narrative is definitely a good villain. And there were out of the many franchises we were doing, I was just like, eh, you know, I don't think they have bad villains, but I can't name all of them. But this was no exception. I was like, yeah, we can name a bunch from here. And
such variety too.
Even if you can't name the episode, even if there's like three different ones with a undead creature or bees attacking or a super enhanced serial killer or even just them running around the countryside looking for a clue that doesn't really have an answer. there's all kinds of stuff here. So was this religious viewing for you, I take it? Hence.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting how even people who weren't really into even just stuff about aliens or federal agent procedurals, it's like even they were able to get into it. It's just like the rare oyster. Somehow it spoke so many different languages.
Yeah, he really tapped into so many different genres that were so appealing. Like, who would have thought the romance aspect of it at the beginning would have had such a long-lasting just grip on everyone?
A giant kind of a chokehold almost. People were insufferable and could not describe it.
It's like, even if you don't want this romance, it will still be here.
Yeah, it'll be in the background reminding you. It's something for everybody.
Yeah.
I've had friends and even my sister who refused to even get into this show, but even they would give it like five more chances because that's just how unusual a show it is. It kind of gets your attention to where you just can't look away. And so it is kind of a funny thing. I wouldn't say it's a hate watch, but you know, even if there was someone of that magnitude, it is like, they're still going to check it out. Cause they're just, it was kind of WTF-ish in moments without trying to be just flat out like gratuitously gross or before even memes were a thing. It's just funny how it just got fathomed up. And
yeah, it's so funny how some people like, oh, I waited like five seasons for my couple to get together, blah blah blah, but people who are watching the X-Files quote unquote only for that, they're like, oh well, I waited seven and I saw an incestuous family, I saw people's guts, like they had to suffer for the ship they wanted to see.
Oh man. And I actually never realized that was Karen Connival, who's done so many other things. She's been in every other Canadian show, including Continuum. She was part of the ensemble playing the apes in the new Rise of the Apes saga. But she's in a hysterical psych episode where they're like at a vacation war clinic. But she was on here about like five different times, and I never realized, oh yeah, she was in that first initial shocking episode. She was the mom.
What a transformative actor. That is just amazing.
Totally. And like every Canadian show, it's going to be a who's who of Supernatural, Stargate, yeah. Highlander, everything. Even movies like Cube or Ginger Snaps, there's a few of those cult actors in there.
Yeah, totally. They just constantly are popping up. I'm so glad they were getting employed during this time. There were so many creepy things for them to be in, too.
Yeah. What are some of your other, like, if you just had to name at least like five others that just you think they've stayed with fans as long as they have, more than just the shocks and how they're written? Why do you think some of them do?
The one that stood out to me the most, that I find the most compelling, is definitely Donnie Faster, and from Irresistible in season two and Orison in season seven. He just sticks out so much because you can really see he really does something different to Scully. Like, Scully is affected by him in ways that she hadn't necessarily before. And that lingers. Like, it bothered her so much what he does.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We brought him up because he was another one where people varied on his various appearances. But just the actor, Nick Chinlin, was just so compelling in that. Freaky.
He He has that interesting thing too with like Model from Pusher and Kitsunagari.
Yes.
He came back and some people really hated his second appearance for both of them, or they thought like, oh, well, you should have left it in the past or whatever. But I personally, specifically with Donnie Faster, really thought it was interesting that they brought him back, considering they thought, quote unquote, that season 7 or season 8 might be their last. And then they're trying to wrap up all of these plot lines. And to Mulder, they look for to Samantha as the reasonable thing that you would want to conclude. But then you look to Scully and what was her biggest thing that she hadn't overcome. It was just that lingering just fear of possession. And you could see it too with the fat sucking monster in Too Shy. Like, she just really seems to have such a fear of men who prey on women and their insecurities, or just when they're vulnerable. And that always stood out to me personally the most. I think my favorite one that I think is fun and like not existential would be, I guess you would call it like fear itself in X-Cops, how you never see it. It manifests differently for everyone. It was just such a cool concept. I kind of wish that it had come back, but it was so much fun to see in that episode. We're like, first it's a werewolf, then it's Freddy Krueger, and then it's like the bee that's attacking the sheriff. And all the while we're following Mulder and Scully with the camera and just trying to figure it out too.
I know what you mean. It was just like it was, out of all the various spoofs of other shows, it kind of, it's just so wild how everyone was just noticing how, yeah, the everything from reality shows like Cops to Blair Witch Project, this just kind of just, it kind of needed that. It just to just make fun of everything. Just unsolved mysteries is like, here's something that really doesn't even matter, and at the same time it's making fun of just the absurdity of all these filming styles.
Yeah. Did you ever hear that anecdote about how Vince Gilligan wanted to make an episode of Unsolved Mysteries with the X-Files? Like, he wanted to hire the no-name actors to play Mulder and Scully in a reenactment of one of their cases, and then have it like cut to the like talking head where they're like, well, I told Mulder that this wouldn't work out or whatever, while it's narrated by the guy. That would have been so funny.
It would have. I mean, I still kind of feel like it's in there, even though it, you know, it didn't make it past the development stages. But I keep just waiting for there to be just a random voiceover or someone who like interrupts the whole flow of the chat.
Yeah, like the record scratch or whatever. How did I get myself in this situation? It just is so cool. But that monster, I think for sure, especially the scene with the coroner where she's so anxious about the hantavirus, we see her working herself to death, literally.
Yeah, you feel a lot of the sweat and tension in the room instead of, it's never static. And I mean, the filmmakers were always good at that, and just creating a mood. Especially for a show with many different moods.
I think another one of my favorite that also has that kind of storytelling change was Hungry in season 7, I think like season 7, episode 3, but where it's the monster who really, he doesn't want to eat brains. He's trying to get better. And it makes that comparison to diet culture where he's trying not to eat. He's trying to like be normal, quote unquote, but he can't help his urges. But it was just so funny seeing it from the monster's point of view, where Mulder is like slowly but surely figuring it out, and seeing that from his perspective, that was just funny to me.
Oh yeah. And it kind of we were kind of noting that earlier, how it kind of goes back to a whole Hammer Horror Universal Monsters is like, hey, I'm bad technically, but I don't mean anything by it, you know. I don't kill with deceit, I don't kill with hate, I just, I gotta eat.
Yeah, just trying to survive.
I did see how director Kim Manners, rest in peace, really dug the actor who played that, Chad Donello.
Yeah.
Noting his subtle, interesting qualities. And that was cool to know, because you really get to, you know, much like Stargate, I do have to applaud all these guys for making it work. For episodes in which the leads don't even appear in, like, they just did their best to just,
yeah,
always make you kind of forget after a while, because it was just so lampoonish. You're like, oh, that's right, where is everyone?
Yeah, that was a really good one. Milagro in season 6, with the writer who wants Scully's heart, quote unquote.
Yes.
He was just fascinating. Definitely
how he's was reading the wrong signals in that prison. Yeah, it's just
yeah,
so much brainwashing. And for whatever reason, that episode kind of reminded me of the one that had Tony Shalhoub, although, you know, where he's like using like laser marks to literally wipe people out who he wants revenge on at like a pharmaceutical company.
Yes, and how like he can just walk a little forward, they'll walk backward into the light, and then all of a sudden mm-hmm. disappear. Yeah, who would have thought a shadow would have been so scary? But they really, that concept paid off in that episode.
All together, I mean, I mean, even people who I know don't like this episode even like it. Because there's just something about, again, how the surreal nature of it.
Yeah.
Oh, but no, that's a good mention, because it's just, you do kind of feel in prison just like the various characters in that, just the way it's shot in the darkness. But yeah, just having the villain just kind of just vanish, almost like Halloween or Terminator. It's like, wait, where did they go?
Mm-hmm.
I'm already freaked out. I had to bring up, are you familiar with Jose Chong?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's just so wild. Like that was the first kind of crossover kind of with the Millennium verse before they actually brought Frank Black over. But it's so wild, because it's just like, yeah, I mean, this guy is a stand-in for kind of Scientology kind of cults who, you know, thrive on your misgivings and rip you off with, you know, millions of dollars later. And what if they were to just inspire people to do like murder suicides? It's just like, so even more overwhelming. It's like, Jesus, I hope not, but I can totally see this happening, because what better way to just make people think it's right when you use religion to excuse the abuse of anything?
Yeah. Especially if people who are in it, it's so insidious to where you can start covering it up, like, yeah. Definitely tapped into one of those like subconscious cultural not fears of twice. Just a group of others, for sure.
I'm right at home. It's all good, man. Oh, but yeah, all together, I mean, it's hard to just kind of describe how they write villains compared to other villains, because it just seems like other shows kind of rely on just, you know, the, for better or worse, for the surprise of a famous actor. They were using all kinds of actors who you could have been almost semi knowledgeable of them, and you still would be like, ah, but I remember them from this episode and that. I want to,
mm-hmm.
even if they didn't give a reason for why they were evil, it's still left an impression, because you're just like, I can tell there's something there without feeling cheated.
Yeah, and it's always just interesting to see what motive track they're going to take with it too. Is it like the town misunderstanding the motives, or like placing blame on something innocent? Is it someone truly evil playing on innocent people?
Is it a revenge?
They really experimented all over. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned the Michael Massey, you know, the Crow fame as one of the Jim Jones type guys, but it was so hard to ring that in, because there's just so many other different cult leaders or death cults, so to speak, or cannibalism is diverse. It's like, man, okay. It's everywhere.
Yeah, they really did pull in a lot of cults that then would have some of the like just most like horrific things associated with them. The Our Town had cannibals, the Signs and Wonders had incest, like just all over the board. They were like, have we done that horrible taboo yet? Let's do it.
Should we? Yeah. Yeah, no, man. Oh. Altogether, what have you been establishing lately with the fanfic exchange? What have you set out to do with that?
Right on. So I wanted to start it to just kind of give people an opportunity to try their hand at fan fiction if they hadn't done it before, especially because a lot of new writers might come onto the scene and maybe not know where to start, or they see other people getting a ton of Tumblr prompts. That's not something that they get themselves. So this like kind of almost in a sense evens the playing field. Newer authors, older authors are getting experience writing for each other. So they get to introduce themselves to one another and then get promoted in a way that's fair and equal. But the structure of it is essentially like Secret Santa, where you'll say what you want as a prompt, and then everyone will get switched and you'll end up writing for someone else, based around like a central theme. So since it's the 30th anniversary of the X-Files this year, we're doing, like seasons or like eras clumps for the themes. So like for February, it's like the baby agent exchange. So all of the prompts had to be like season one and season two. And nice. We're just going to kind of go through that, especially because it'll help people who maybe only write kind of like the romantic peak of season seven, per se. Like now you have to try writing them in season two. And like it's a whole different tone. So we're doing that this year, but yeah, that's why I kind of started it and why I promoted it, is just to kind of give people a fair chance to try fan fiction out for themselves.
Very nice. And given a whole love of what a writer's room even is.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Oh, I hope you're able to keep sharing a lot of that and, keep working with all these lovely people.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I hope you get to keep doing your podcast with all the cool themes.
Oh, I try. I try.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jam.